Located on Southeast 71st and Division.
Yes, thank you.
Between Division and Powell, yeah.
Yeah, we're trying to get as many supporters out there as we can, as much media out there as we can, so we can bring as much attention to this as possible.
Sounds great. And anything else planned after that, or you're gonna see how that goes and then go from there?
I think we're kind of in one day at a time to battle this, because it does change rapidly from when it started 2 weeks ago. So we're hoping for the best. We really deserve to stay put.
Absolutely.
That's our message. Mm-hmm.
Well, I want to just give you kudos for the work that you all are doing in this fighting for your kids and for a place that really that those kids deserve, right? So thank you so much, all three of you, for joining us. It's been great. Also, thanks to our engineer, Mike. And you've been listening to Labor Radio. Tune in next Monday and every Monday at 6 o'clock to catch another Labor Radio show.
Thank you.
Thank you for bringing the attention.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel?
Good evening. This is Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland. I'm Karen James. My guest tonight is Doyle Smith, Executive Director of DDA of Oregon. DDA, or Dual Diagnosis Anonymous, is a unique 12 steps plus 5 recovery program for those suffering from mental illness and addiction. Welcome, Doyle.
Hello, Karen. Thank you for having me.
So, Doyle, can you explain what is dual diagnosis?
Dual diagnosis is when people have a mental illness associated with their diagnosis on top of an addiction issue with their diagnosis. So it's dual.
And both of us know and love the founder of DDA of Oregon, Corbett Monica, who mm-hmm. we lost several years ago. For listeners who don't know Corbett, can you say a few words about Corbett?
Yeah, the founder of Dual Diagnosis Anonymous of Oregon, Inc., Corbett Monica, actually started DDA in Fontana, California in 1996, and he came up to Oregon in 1998, which I met him when he was a supervisor at DePaul Treatment Center, and I started my counseling career, and that's when I first met Corbett. First DDA of Oregon meeting started at DePaul Treatment Center in 1998. Corbett was working inside of the prisons in Bridgepoint, which was a mental health treatment program, and I was working in Turning Point, which was the addiction mental health service provider inside the prisons. And we worked collaboratively as contractors with Behavioral Health Services. That at the time was ASAP that got merged with Cascadia Behavioral Health Care. And while we were there, Corbett was doing DDA for part of the programs that he was working for. When it was being recognized for how it was working for people, they helped him take it to the state, and the state gave him his first contract in the year 2003, I think, or 2001, I can't remember for sure.
So the Department of Corrections,
helped
him.
There was a few people, Janet Perdosi. It's on our webpage in terms of the history of DDA, but there was a lot of people that were supporters of DDA inside of the prison at the time, Max Williams being one of them, and when Corbett was able to get the information to the state and they were interested, DDA was set in action back then. And when Corbett, that was in 2005, when he came back in 2007, he'd established 57 DDA meetings along the I-5 corridor between Portland Oregon State Hospital and the Oregon State Hospital in Salem. And so he received further funding from the state, which until about 2011 started getting reduced. A position became available as assistant director, which I applied for, and I got it. And then 2 years later, I applied for the executive director position, which is he was retiring and stepping down. Corbett actually passed away in 2015. I started in 2014. A lot of people don't know that he was a universal minister, and me and my wife, Debbie Smith, were married by Corbett Monica.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
So since becoming executive director of DDA of Oregon, in what direction have you taken DDA?
Well, since becoming the executive director, we've implemented a workbook that Corbett wrote, which got a syllabus, and it started what we would consider competency in terms of skill building, and it's a little augmented from the regular 12-step traditional groups that we also have.
So what exactly is the workbook?
The workbook is called Dual Diagnosis Anonymous, 12 Steps Plus 5. It's basically an exercise book that shows how to work the steps of DDA in a way that would help them manage their symptoms and prevent relapse.
So talk about how DDA works, this 12 steps plus 5.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that.
Well, it's a grassroots organization, and even though DDA of Oregon got organized through the prison system when Corbett was recognized, he literally brought it from Fontana, California in 1996. He started it there. It didn't get organized, it didn't get promoted, it didn't get funded until like 1998. And it was based on people being kicked out of a traditional AA 12-step meeting because of their symptoms and being on medications. And when he got it organized, it seemed to be the missing link of treating both symptoms dually at the same time, recognizing in DDA we see both illnesses, the addiction and the mental illness, equally. But most people that come to our meetings don't fit into, because of the stigma, because the misunderstanding within them and outside people. I hear all the time, my family doesn't even understand. They just say, stop it. And they'll listen to people talking in our meetings and they'll go, how come I've never heard of this before? This is what I've needed. This is the missing link, is what they usually comment. We had a focus group done through Dartmouth University, Pacific University, and Dual Diagnosis Anonymous in 2012. And we have evidence-based research done now based on the outcomes that we gathered between the Oregon State Hospital, the prisons, and the DDA meetings on the outside and in housing. And that has been put in an article that's on our webpage. And there's been a couple other researches. SAMHSA's recognized us for peers in recovery. We've gotten awards from NAMI. We've gotten a lot of recognition through the state. And it just seems to be, not for everybody, but for over 4,000 contacts a month throughout just the state of Oregon, it seems to be working really well. We were in as many as 34 of the 36 counties. Yeah, but it varies. DDA meetings pop up and go down without our knowledge because it's such a big thing with oversight. There's a World Service DDA, which Corbett managed before he passed, and then there's DDA of Oregon, Inc., which is what I direct. And there's three people running a statewide agency of about 4,000 contacts a month, mm-hmm. with hourly worked.
So the 12 steps plus 5, the 12 steps are Alcoholics Anonymous.
They were based on the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous because of the history of DDA started when we were attending AA and then doing mental illness recovery treatment in a program called the STEMS program. What Corbett did in 1996 was try to help a group of individuals that were coming from the STEMS program into an AA meeting and that they had been getting help from because they were paranoid schizophrenic alcoholics.
So they were dually diagnosed.
They were dually diagnosed, exactly. And in 96, this is basically how they were working with them. And the history goes, Ruben and Steve were symptomatic this particular meeting. And after the meeting was over, Corbett was asked by the group conscious not to bring those two gentlemen back. So Corbett contacted World Service AA office in New York City, asked him what he should do about it, and they told him to start his own meeting, which was when he got permission to use the 12 steps of AA with a disclaimer, which is part of our literature, and then he added 5 steps for the mental health piece. What I think resonates mostly with our program is it's not just for the people with the mental health conditions, which is usually contrary to 12 steps, is that you don't include, it's anonymous. So you wouldn't want to have the professionals, and even though the big book talks about work with the clergy, work with your doctors, DDA, it's absolutely necessary. the support from the corrections, from the family, from the prescriber, because that's exactly how this stuff works for success.
A holistic approach.
A holistic approach, yeah. Exactly.
So, Doyle, you said that this started, DDA began when Corbett took two people that were dually diagnosed to a Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and they became symptomatic and were asked not to come back.
Absolutely.
So talk about these symptoms of mental illness, the types of mental illness and types of addictive behaviors.
Just so you know, I'm a man in recovery from mental illness and addiction myself. I got over 24 years of continuous recovery from being an alcoholic and being a meth addict. And I have anxiety disorder. I have attention deficit disorder. And I have some depression. And what you'll see with people with addictions is usually they are masking their illness with managing their symptoms with destructive means or drugs. Or behavior. And you'll see gambling addiction being one of the highest suicide rates amongst all addictions. And it's interesting, there's no drugs involved in terms of that. And you'll also see a lot of people that don't think they have mental health conditions, and they're trying to make it in traditional 12-step meetings, but they don't think they're working the program hard enough, when it's not a defect of character, when it's something, when you say you can't be happy or you can't get out of bed when you're severely depressed, when you think you're just lazy. And DDA, it shows where it can differentiate between defects of character and symptoms. Illnesses are a funny thing, because an addiction is an illness. Mental illness is an illness. And it's the two illnesses that seem to not get the proper treatment compared to most illnesses. And definitely not the proper support. Stigmas are a big thing that keep people from coming to get help and or promote the relapses. More people would rather identify with being an addict than they would mental illness. And we've even been asked to remove that from time to time in terms of it being a negative word, in terms of what people should be thinking about themselves in terms of promoting health. And what I say is that stigmatizes it, because you would not want to change the word cancer if you were trying to treat cancer. And what we want to do is identify that we are not our mental illness, that we suffer from a diagnosis that, once you clarify what it is, it shows you what to do about it. And when you can have a group of individuals that can come together with what I call methodical, measurable approach to recovery in a competent way, then they can get a clue in terms of what has to be done. Most of them know how to work the system because they've been involved with the system. I've seen some people that come to our meetings be better than the counselors that treat them, and they're not even certified. And it's because they've been in and out and in and out and in and out, and they know what works for them. And Dual Diagnosis Anonymous of Oregon has got a 12-step feel to it, but it also has difference in terms of how we can have crosstalk and process stuff. We also have resources that are made available, and we do not kick people out of meetings. We have the five rules of respect that starts off our meetings just for that reason.
What would you say to someone that is out there suffering and maybe using drugs, drinking, or gambling, as you say, masking this pain with these behaviors? What would you say to someone, or maybe a family member or friend, who sees these behaviors and knows something's wrong?
Well, our mission statement is to live without hope is to cease to live. And I would say that there's hope. And I would also say that you're not alone and you're not broken. When you can understand that there's a place that can identify with the symptoms or the circumstances that you're going through, there is a what you can call an efficacy or a desire or a motivation that they hadn't seen before. And what happens in DDA, and it's, you know, it's obviously not for everybody, but what I know about DDA is when people find out about us and we're talking the language, it's called pure efficacy to self-efficacy. And it shows somebody gets brought along when they didn't think there was anywhere to go prior to that. And I guess what I would say is that like what I say at the end of each DDA meeting is we actually give a moment of silence for those that are still suffering, because my sister died from this stuff, my mom died from this stuff, and there will be a lot of people that will die from this stuff. But the people that make it to, whether you're arrested or you're incarcerated or put in an institution, we try to meet you there and talk your language and show you that you're not alone. And then we normalize the mental health issues and show you that this is just an illness like any other, that if you can see it differently and remove all the bull crap that everything that surrounds it, you'll start getting better. And it's proven by the lives that have changed in the way that they live after they start doing DDA.
So Doyle, folks attending Dual Diagnosis Anonymous of Oregon do have to have a willingness to change. Is that correct?
Absolutely. In time, though, I mean, there's what we call efficacy or desire or hope is usually what we would also call a willingness. It's actually our second step of our five steps. And what that means, though, is that sometimes you're brought in by other means, and the willingness is really just to not suffer anymore. And it's not always thinking of as willingness.
Oh, so you get them in the door first, and then...
Well, sometimes not. Social workers bring them in because of the acute symptoms sometimes, and then people come in because of legal matters, or some people come in because of family, or people come in because they've heard of it, and do treatment programs. But what I would say is, I don't think anybody shows up to a hospital or a traditional 12-step meeting willingly. And the reason why I say that, and I used to say this when I counsel all the time, is because I know that you would be willingly wanting to be somewhere a lot different than this if you had a choice.
But then they get hooked.
Yeah. Bring your body, your mind will follow. And this is a biopsychosocial disorder, so it's kind of weird how that works. The social piece is the part that makes it work, because anything that needs a reference or a condition has to be done socially.
With our recent shootings and the information in the media about mental illness, do you feel stigma is lessening a bit around this issue?
Yeah, there's a lot of research that's actually making it a lot easier. It's not as taboo, but there's still, I mean, even the mental illness or the mental health treatment providers and the addiction providers are siloed apart. There still needs to be a lot of work in terms of how we combine the support, the help, the models, the approaches, even in the system that helps address the issues, on top of outside with the media and how people still see mental illness as not an illness or just being crazy. Mm-hmm. And that is a huge problem, huge problem. I went to an event where people were talking about how to remove stigma, and I heard something very interesting. And one of the things was that it's not going to be removed unless we remove it, meaning the people that suffer from it. And people are not going to listen unless we make them listen.
Mm-hmm. You know, integrated treatment, treating both the addiction plus the mental illness, this is just new in recent years. I mean, you know, a decade ago, you know, it wasn't really prevalent.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I can't speak on exactly why that is. I know there's a lot of issues with pharmacology and the prescriptions and the way funding comes down the plank. But I do know that when you get something that, you know, when we talk about approaches and what's evidence-based and what works or what's anecdotal, we have over 4,000 contacts a month. There's people that are starting this in Guam. One of our biggest workbook study groups is in Guam, when only 3 people made it to a meeting in San Diego when I did it for an alternatives conference, because it was done at a time when everybody went to a dance. So not a lot of people showed up to our meeting, but we had 3 people. And out of those 3 people, one of them took that meeting from San Diego to Guam, and it's on our Facebook, and she shows pictures of all the people that are doing that workbook study now. So one person can make a difference.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And speaking of making a difference, you talk about, in DDA of Oregon, Doyle, you talk about the importance and the effectiveness of peer support.
Absolutely. I'm a certified alcohol and drug counselor, and I've been in the business for a long time. And I've worked with programming and outcomes, and we've seen a huge spike in terms of sustainability or relapse prevention in terms of when peer support's involved. The Varsity Badgeby wrote a program called the Burn Grant for Multnomah County Mental Health, and They introduced it at Columbia River Correction Institution when I was transitioning people there, and it was a huge success at the time. And they still continue that through other organizations. But it, what it showed is that the gap is the most important piece when people are getting help, especially with mental illness. They should be really addressing the process of recovery a lot better in terms of what the triple aim with the coordinated care organizations in the state of Oregon call it, the cost effectiveness. The cost effectiveness with peer support seems to be the thing that makes the most difference with the less cost. And so they're really trying to figure this thing out in terms of developing an infrastructure around peer support now. Allie Linfoot of Clackamas County Behavioral Healthcare, one of the pioneers right now in terms of leading, you know, a process of how it's for peers, made by peers, developed by peers, and it's for peers to be doing peer support and how we get certified. Eric Martin, that runs the certification process for counselors in the state of Oregon, has done a really good job with helping promote the proper direction for people to get certified and competent in terms of presenting peer support. You can get a peer support certification now that covers a lot of different areas instead of just one alcoholic helping another, you can't keep it unless you give it away thing. You know, it really has gotten to the point now where there's a competency involved in terms of outcomes, and rightly so. The template really was a 12-step model back in the day when AA started this with Bill W. and Dr. Bob. And it's been a template of our, what Corbett would refer to it as, the grandmother of all programs, because millions of people attend AA to this day that are successful. But there, a time has come to where we recognize how that's been promoted into all the other A's that keep you out of the DA that can be utilized because of that template. And it's very effective when it's done right.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prison Pipeline on KBOO 90.7 FM. My guest is Doyle Smith, Executive Director of DDA of Oregon, and we're discussing Dual Diagnosis Anonymous of Oregon's recovery program for those suffering from mental illness and addiction. Doyle, I know you are not currently in the Oregon prison system. That was one of the main programs that Corbett loved and did a lot of work inside the prisons with Dual Diagnosis Anonymous. And you are in some of the county jails right now. Why aren't you in the prisons?
Well, currently we're not in the prisons because of a funding issue. And we used to be in the prisons. Actually, the prisons, Columbia River Correction Institution has a rich history with DDA in terms of how Corbett worked there. I worked there through Cascadia at the time, and how they promoted us to move on through the state and had a contract with us. And since then, funding has not been made available is why. We do not have the luxury of volunteers like other 12-step programs because of the mental health component, and it costs us money to do things. We get our funding through contracts, grants, and fundraisers. And there was, way back in 2011, a misunderstanding with DDA, and we've been trying to correct that since then. But we have been present in the prison system in terms of keynote speakers and doing orientations and presentations to people that are incarcerated through their program services.
Do you have any information on recidivism for people that go through DDA?
No, I don't have per se that are directly connected to DDA by itself, but with the combination of peer support, there's a lot of statistics, and that's why I was kind of giving a shout out to Allie, because she's done a lot of good research outcome-based stuff, which is really hard to do. I know that when we did the peer support mentoring piece through Columbia River, there was a 35% increase in lowering the risk factors and success rates in the first year.
And not only decreasing recidivism, but also decreasing decompensation.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's exactly right.
Explain what decompensation is.
Decompensation is when somebody becomes more maladaptive, or somebody that decreases their skills or becomes more harmful to themselves or others, depending on what their diagnoses are. You know, and one of the things that's different about other 12-step meetings is if you start what you said, decompensating or having relapse behaviors with the addiction piece, it's like you are dry drunk or you're not working a good enough program. Here's the thing about mental illness, and what sets us apart is that people have no control over their mental illness sometimes. And when we're taking medications, or if we become symptomatic because of stressors and or just not taking care of herself right, eating, sleeping is a big factor for a lot of people, then decompensation will show in terms of their symptoms. I almost want to use a famous person here locally that had a run-in with the police in Washington County, but I won't say his name. He was not drunk or loaded, and he crashed into five cop cars, and he got convicted under being mentally ill. And what I would say is that it's good to go back to the hospital. It's actually recovery orientated to be hospitalized or see your prescriber or get put on different medications, because that's the process of recovery. It's not a bad thing. It's a good thing. We have people that work for us that at certain times of the year become decompensated because of the trauma that happened during those months, usually around the Christmas time or the beginning of the year. There's lots of things that can trigger some of these things. And you would not think that it would be a healthy thing to go back to the hospital when it is a healthy thing to go back to the hospital, just like if you were ill from any other illness, you would want to be seen.
Mm-hmm. And some people with mental illness don't have that insight
to recognize
that they are decompensating. A group like DDA of Oregon would recognize those behaviors in their members.
Wow, yes, absolutely. That's exactly right. When we are in a group, people that are in their mental illness, a lot of the times don't realize it because it's something they're used to or they're too far removed inside themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because of the love and the fellowship. We call it a fellowship and not a program because we're family, we're brothers and sisters, and that's what Corbett started. And if I could just say this real quick, it's our preamble, and it really kind of wraps up what DDA truly is. And it's a fellowship of persons who share their experience, strengths, weaknesses, feeling, fears, and hopes with one another to resolve their dual diagnosis and or learn to live at peace with unresolved problems. And the only requirement is to live a healthy drug and alcohol-free lifestyle and help others. And that's what we do. When you're not alone anymore, when you feel like somebody understands, when you can get the promotion of how you can manage the symptoms or even get some feedback around your medication so you stay on it and just don't get off because you're having side effects and feel rest assured that they're just going to be for a little bit, or get them off them because they won't work. You know, we're not professionals, but we have a wealth of experience that help each other, and that's what we need.
How can we help DDA of Oregon get back in the prison system? What is needed, Doyle?
I've had meetings in the past where there was some promises of being made in terms of funding us again, like we used to be funded in order to be able to bring our meetings in there. The best way of getting back into the prison systems is to reestablish a partnership with DOC that would have to start with Colette Peters, would have to start with officials that really have the ability to move and promote our program. And if they would just give us the time that we could show them what we've done and where we're at and what we can do, it would be, how do I say this, irresponsible to not at least take a look and try.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And people that have loved ones and or have been incarcerated themselves that have experienced this, you can send letters to DDA, and we would keep those when we ask for meetings to show the need.
We do get letters
from people that send us from prisons a lot of the time.
And let me say that mailing address. It's DDA of Oregon, and the mailing address is P.O. Box 2883, Portland, Oregon, 97208. Well, I hope our listeners follow through, Doyle. Winding down here, Doyle Smith from DDA of Oregon, can you talk briefly about the first steps in getting help for anyone out there that is considering contacting DDA?
The first steps for getting help through DDA is our central office, which is downtown Portland, 521 Southwest 11th Street, which we have DDA meetings Monday through Friday, 12 to 1. But we also have literature, workbooks. And so if you call the phone number 503-222-6484, that's 503-222-6484, you can get our administrative service manager, Jennifer Springsteen, and we could give you more information about how you can get more involved. We're always looking for volunteers. We're always looking for people to help us get the word out. We're always taking donations and we're raising funds. So there's a lot of different categories that we use. We need help with, but mainly to support you, to give you a voice and give you an understanding that you're not alone, that there is hope that there is a way out of this. They said I would never amount to be anything or anybody in the first grade. I actually flunked twice because I came from a very abusive alcoholic and drug mentally ill environment. And I'm the executive director of a nonprofit organization now. So don't let people tell you what you can't do.
Absolutely. And I just want to say that you have a lot of materials that you can download on the website. Yep. Also, all of the meetings around the state are listed on your website. I'm going to read that. It's DDA of Oregon, all one word, DDAofOregon.com.
We also have a Facebook, which is really important to like, and that's not DDA of Oregon, it's Dual Diagnosis Anonymous. You have to write that out, and it'll show up. And we have some events coming up, and we do campouts, picnics, bowling events, things like that, too.
Oh, fun stuff, too.
Yeah, very much fun stuff.
So, Doyle, thank you for being on Prison Pipeline, and best of luck getting back into the prisons, and I hope our listeners will help us out on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Karen. It's been a privilege and an honor to be here again. I appreciate your time.
I've been speaking with Doyle Smith, Executive Director of DDA of Oregon. This is Prison Pipeline on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland. Listen to this and previous Prison Pipeline programs at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Like Prison Pipeline on Facebook. Thank you to our engineers, Danielle and Mike. Good night.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of The Beautiful Party on Thursday, December 14th at 6 p.m. at The Know in Portland. The Beautiful Party is a video premiere hip-hop birthday event. There will also be performances, samples, and other surprises at this 21 and over event. Again, that's The Beautiful Party on Thursday, December 14th at 6 p.m. at The Know, 3728 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO provides free training in all aspects of operating a radio station. We're looking for folks who benefit from white privilege to attend the Beloved Community 101 training on Saturday, December 16th from noon to 3 p.m. This workshop focuses on understanding how KBOO culture